Hi, welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann. I'm the founder and the editor of sleepjunkies.com. And if you've not been here before, well, what do we do here? Well, the podcast is all about covering the whole conversation on sleep. We talk about everything to do with sleep. So we cover the health, the science, the culture of sleep, interesting sleep products, and sleep technology. If there's an interesting story and it's got anything to do with sleep, then we'll cover it. And we talk to a whole range of experts from the world of sleep, including researchers, scientists, innovators and inventors, sleep advocates, people from the sleep industry. So we like to think of sleep as a universal topic, and hopefully there's something for everybody here. So today the topic is going to be something that we've covered before. Now, a few years back, we wrote a piece on sleep myths, debunking 33 of the most common myths to do with sleep. And you can find that on the website, sleepjunkies.com. And today, I thought we'd take a bit of a deeper dive into the subject. So we're just going to cover 6 or 7 of these myths. So our guest today is someone who's been involved in sleep science and research for over 30 years. So he's well qualified to talk about the subject. Also, our guest is somebody who's not afraid to express his opinions. Occasionally, we're sparring partners on Twitter, and he will pull me up on an article or something I've posted on there. So I thought he'd be a good person to speak to about busting some of these common sleep myths. So today we're talking to Dr. Neil Stanley, and I hope you'll find the conversation interesting. And if you like what you heard today, then go ahead and subscribe on iTunes, on Google Play, wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a little review. These things help raise the profile of the podcast and just get the message about what a great thing sleep is into the wider world. We're also all over social media. You can check us out on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. So go ahead and hit one of those follow buttons as well. That's it for the intro. Really hope you enjoy the discussion, and we'll see you on the next one. This morning I'm joined with Dr. Neil Stanley, and I'm really pleased to have him on the end of the line. And Neil has got a long-standing history in as a researcher and a scientist, and I'll let him talk a little bit more about that. So hi Neil, how are you doing?
Good morning. Yeah, I mean, it's great to be here.
I often ask guests to kind of give me an elevator pitch for their product or their service, but you're not promoting anything except yourself. So can you give our listeners just a very brief overview of who you are? Actually, before we do that, there's a brilliant bit on your website that I'd just like to read out just as a preface to your introduction. So on your website, sleepconsultancy.com, on the about page, it made me laugh. So I'm just going to read it out. It says, Dr. Neil Stanley, what I am not. I'm not, and these are all in inverted commas here, I'm not a sleep advocate, sleep diplomat, sleep practitioner, sleep educator, sleep evangelist, sleep therapist, sleep physiologist, sleep czar, sleep environmental analyst, sleep fairy, sleep guru, sleep geek, sleep solution expert, sleep ambassador, sleep health navigator, sleep solution expert, international sleep speaker, and educator, or any other fancy title. I am a sleep expert, plain and simple. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. I mean, I am a sleep expert. I mean, I've been involved in sleep research for the last 36 years. Initially worked alongside the Royal Air Force at the Institute of Aviation Medicine, looking at things like aircrew workload, jet lag, shift work, medicines you can take and safely fly. In the early 90s, I moved to the University of Surrey, where I created and ran the world's largest clinical trial sleep laboratory, a 24-bed unit, and as part of that, I designed and constructed the 12 finest bedrooms built anywhere on the planet. I've been involved in clinical sleep in London, in Surrey, in Copenhagen, and in Oslo. I've got a collection of over 1,200 sleep books. So if I'm not reading about it or talking about it, I'm writing about it or doing it. I've been an independent sleep expert for the last 10 years now, and I travel the world talking about the importance of sleep to anybody who will listen to me, basically, members of the public, healthcare professionals, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason for writing that on the website is, unfortunately, anybody can set themselves up as a sleep expert, and or any of those pretentious made-up names that they have for themselves, job titles that they have. And that's really quite concerning. You can become a sleep practitioner with only 3 days training. You wouldn't trust your cat to a vet that only had 3 days training. You wouldn't trust your child to a school bus driver who only had 3 days training. So I cannot imagine why you would trust something as important as your sleep to somebody who only had 3 days training. And that's one of the scandals in the sleep field.
I've seen some of these people describing themselves as certified sleep consultant. And I thought, hang on, what's that? And so I've Googled it, and it's a course you can do for $200 or whatever. And I think it is, as you say, 3 days training. And you get a certificate to put on your wall or wherever on your LinkedIn profile. And then you're a certified sleep consultant. And I think one of the problems is, I think we've talked about this, is that your doctor, they don't receive any specialist sleep training. If you do a medical degree, I think in the States, it's like 3 or 4 hours over 4 years. So the public are kind of a little bit hoodwinked about who the experts really are a lot of the time, I think.
It is a problem. I mean, you know, you say in America it's 3 or 4 hours. In the UK, I mean, this was figures back from the 1990s. It was 5 minutes. Wow. Learning about sleep at medical school in 7 years. And those 5 minutes were solely devoted to sleep apnea. So if you've got any of the other 95 sleep disorders in the International Classification of Sleep Disorders, you really don't stand a chance. And the thing is, there's a difference between sleepers' wellness, which, you know, anybody can talk about, and, you know, anybody can give the rules of sleep hygiene that they don't work, but anybody can just give them off rote. And then there's sleep as an illness, as a medicine, as a problem that will have, you know, profound ramifications. And this is where the lines have been terribly, terribly blurred.
Yeah.
And people are using words like sleep therapist when, one, they know nothing about sleep, and two, they're not a registered therapist. I mean, if you do cognitive behavioral therapy for depression or anxiety, you need to have done 200 hours of clinical practice. You need to be registered. But if you're doing it for sleep, you can do CBTI or acceptance therapy without any training as a therapist and with little knowledge about sleep. And so you're seeing patients, and that scares me. I know, you know, as much about sleep as any person, and I would not see a patient because I'm not a therapist. And when you consider that insomnia is comorbid to so many other conditions, things like depression or anxiety, I know about sleep, but I couldn't recognize a depressed or a suicidal patient, and I really wouldn't want to go there myself.
Yeah. I often think about it. I mean, we deal a lot with sleep technology, and we've talked about this before. And I think at the moment, with such an increased interest over the last 5 or 10 years, there's loads of stuff going on. There's loads of innovation. But on a wider scale, there's a general increase in the interest in sleep. And I think about it as a little bit of a Wild West sort of period we're going through, where everyone is talking about sleep at the moment. But there's a big gap in public education. So I think, you know, I totally agree with what you're saying, but I think there's an education gap that needs to be plugged. And hopefully by doing these podcasts and speaking to people like you, that's kind of where I see the role of sleep junkies and just letting people know a bit more about this stuff. So let's move on. So today we're going to bust a few myths, a few common sleep myths. And the reason I invited Neil onto the podcast is we've met in person, but we kind of communicate mostly online and via Twitter. I wouldn't like to call you a debunker, Neil, but would it be fair to say you've got a low threshold for how should we call it, fake news, let's, you know, to be polite, with regards to sleep?
I think the problem comes, as you say, there is an education gap, and people have plunged into this. There's now more information about sleep than there's ever been before. I mean, on a daily basis, I put a new sleep tip out, which I collect from the internet. And you know, I'm now over 2,000 sleep tips that have been proposed. And the problem is it's sorting the wheat from the chaff. And most of the sleep tips that we've been given are at least 100, if not more, years old. And they patently aren't making any difference to people. And we can endlessly repeat them. But it's actual education. And there's that deficit. People know a lot about sleep or think they know a lot of sleep, but at the end of the day, they're just not doing it. And that's the key thing. I mean, it's like having, you know, every one of Jamie Oliver's cookbooks in your kitchen. That doesn't make you a good cook. You actually have to use the information in those books. And that's the issue with sleep. And a lot of nonsense is being spoken. And I think that, you know, we need clarity. People need to know what is good, what is bad, and what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing, because anything other than that is just going to make the problem worse.
Okay, absolutely. Well, let's dive in. And so the first thing I'd like to talk about and debunk is this idea that sleep is a passive activity. The famous quote from Thomas Edison, 100 years ago or so, is that sleep is a criminal waste of time. Now, he had a vested interest because he just invented the light bulb and he wanted everyone to stay awake and use his light bulbs. But that notion has kind of carried on for over 100 years, that when we go to sleep, it's basically downtime for the body and the brain. And I think a lot of people still consider sleep as, you know, a bit of a waste of time, could be getting on with more productive stuff. Neil, I'll hand over to you on that subject.
Yeah, I mean, this is true. As you say, Edison, you know, invented the light bulb. And he also ran factories. He needed his workers to work. And anything, you know, everybody sees Edison as a genius, but he was a typical Victorian employer. He wanted to use and abuse his workers. But yes, it has become. And of course, now we have this perception of, you know, all these people boasting about how little sleep they need. I mean, you know, the heir to Edison, of course, is Elon Musk, who, you know, very recently said how little sleep he was getting. And this is all just bravado. There's no evidence, even for Edison, that they ever slept a small amount. And we know that Thatcher, that was all a myth, that she only needed 4 hours. But we have this idea that sleep's a waste of time, nothing important happens. And you talk about, you know, people working long hours, but it's not even that. It's, you know, binge watching things on streaming services, which we've replaced. And in the past, getting sleep was easy because, you know, TV went off at 11, pubs closed at 11, and late night shopping was 6 o'clock on a Thursday night. So we didn't have anything competing with it. And it's hard to explain to somebody that sleep is important and that things happen. You know, our metabolic rate during the night only drops by 15%, because we've still got to run the body. It's not like the body in any way shuts down. We're still running.
Just to break that down into sort of more layman terms, you're talking about the amount of energy that we expend at night.
Yeah, I mean, our metabolic rate, we need to keep, you know, we need to keep the engine ticking over, because, you know, the cells are working, our brains are working, our lungs are working, our heart's working. So we need to still be active. It's not like you go to sleep and everything shuts off. The only thing that shuts off during the night are parts of the brain, and it's only during the night that the brain can in any way shut down, and it's about a 25% reduction in brain activity overnight. So there's an awful lot that's still going on, and we know that sleep is involved in, you know, memory and in learning, and you only grow during the night. You actually only grow during deep sleep during the night. So it's a very productive time because it allows the body to do its housekeeping, to flush out neurotoxins, to repair, to recuperate. And so sleep is really, really quite an active process, although, you know, as you say, through all of history, it hasn't been something that we've talked about or we've analysed. I mean, you know, areas like the sociology of sleep have only been talking about sleep for the last 15, 20 years, because before that it was thought to be a completely selfish act that had no ramifications to anybody. But we know that we kick and we punch and we snore and we move during the night, and that can have ramifications for both the sleeper as well as the bed partner. So there is a huge area of sleep that which we only are really delving into now, rather than, as you say, just seeing it as some sort of passive state that, you know, we can do without if we want, because we'll be fine because nothing much happens.
I see it as kind of a return to common sense, because you talk to, let's say, the older generation, and they won't kind of question the attitudes. You know, it's common sense. Get a good night's sleep and you'll feel better in the morning and you'll be more awake, blah, blah, blah. Historically, sleep has been, we just do it and we feel better. We don't know why, but we feel better in the morning. But in the modern era, let's say Edison onwards, you know, that's kind of been challenged. And, you know, well, actually, humans, we're quite smart. Maybe we can do without sleep. And then we're now realizing with research and science that actually we do actually need sleep. And so I sort of see it as a return back to common sense, you know, before the era when we knew anything about sleep.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And this is I mean, it's a human failing, isn't it, that we are stupid enough to think we're clever enough. We do think that somehow, you know, the phrase is used these days is somehow we can hack sleep. Yep. The problem is, you know, after a million years of evolution, this is it. This is the answer. We perhaps don't understand what the question ever was, but this way we sleep is the answer. And there's no way that in the next 5 years with technology, we're going to hack sleep.
There's lots of people trying.
Lots of people trying, and they'll fail miserably every single time, because this is evolution. It's like, you know, why would we want to change that? I mean, if you remember growing up in and watching the movies from the 50s and 60s, where, you know, sci-fi movies, where we're all going to eat vitamin pills, yeah, we're going to get our meal in pill form. Well, we could do that if we wanted to, but somehow we've never come around to that. Why? Because it's a good thing, and you get pleasure and enjoyment. And I think that's one bit that's been forgotten about sleep, is that it is an incredibly pleasurable activity for the vast majority of people. And why would you want to give that up just to work more, unpaid for your boss? I mean, that's, or to watch the latest series of Game of Thrones. That seems to be a very strange bargain.
It was quite good, man. With
I never got into it, to be honest.
Well, I know that the military have been trying to hack sleep for, well, probably forever. But I know they're at the forefront of this research of the, you know, the soldier who can keep vigil for 48 hours or something.
Yeah, the 7-day soldier, the DARPA program in America, where all these wake promoting agents come from. I mean, there's a funny story where US military pilots were using modafinil as a wake promoting agent, and they said they didn't like it because you didn't get the buzz that you get from amphetamine. So, you know, that scares me on so many levels. But yes, this idea of a 7-day soldier, and yet, you know, other American military research shows that the more sleepy you are, you know, your judgment when shooting is impaired. You can shoot just as accurately and just as quickly. You just shoot the wrong person.
Yeah, it doesn't inspire much confidence.
So. Well, you look at all these cases of friendly fire, and you have to wonder, is this a good or bad thing? And I think it's the idea of somebody fighting for 7 days without sleep really is a scary world that I don't want to be part of.
Exactly. All right. Debunked, I think we can say that one. let's move on to the next point. So this is quite a common one, and, you know, some subtleties in this one. But it's this idea that as we get older, we need less sleep. And not to lead your answer, but my take on this is that there is a correlation. It does happen. Older people often do experience more disrupted sleep. But I think some people have this belief that as we get older, because we see older people getting less sleep, that we need less sleep. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the second most prevalent myth in sleep, the first one being that we all need 8 hours. And this comes about, as you say, because of subtle changes in the sleep that we have, but it is untrue. Old people do not need less sleep. An 85-year-old needs the same amount of sleep that they did when they were 25. What becomes more difficult is that they find it harder to get the sleep they need. And what happens is, as you get older, you start losing the deep sleep, which is the most restorative part of sleep, so-called N3 sleep or deep slow wave sleep. And this you lose progressively. And so when you get into your 60s or 70s, you have very little deep sleep. So sleep becomes actually less refreshing. And so an elderly person can sleep all the way through the night, maybe get up to the bathroom once or twice. But when they wake up in the morning, they don't feel refreshed. I mean, if you remember when you were 20, your head hit the pillow, you died for 9 hours and you woke up and you felt absolutely on top of the world. Well, an elderly person can do the same, sleep through the night, but wake up and think, what was the point of that? So they haven't got the refreshment. And the other thing about losing deep, slow wave sleep is the sleep that children have a lot of because it's involved in memory, learning, and growth. So they spend a lot of the night in deep sleep. And as anybody knows, children can sleep anywhere through anything. And if they wake up, they can go straight back to sleep because there's a lot of pressure for you to go back to sleep. The problem is if you don't have that deep sleep, one, you're more easily woken up, and two, when you are awake, there's no pressure for you to go back to sleep. And as you get older, of course, there are probably more things to wake you up, pain, needing to go to the bathroom, snoring, bed partner, or whatever. Now, when you were 20, you would have got up, gone to the bathroom, got back into bed and fallen straight back to sleep, and so you wouldn't have seen that as an issue. But when you get older, you find it much more difficult to go back to sleep. So you're lying awake there with no pressure to go back to sleep. And that's when you notice your pains and you notice your partner snoring and you're awake for an hour and a half. And that contributes to that lack of sleep. So it's a natural change that happens, which makes it more difficult for us to get sleep. But that doesn't mean that the elderly need less sleep. One other change that happens in the elderly is that they want to go to sleep earlier. There's a shift in their biological rhythms, which means that the elderly can potentially wake up early in the morning. And if they do that, again, there is this issue of if they wake up in the morning, they may feel that they need less sleep simply because they feel they're waking up early, not really realizing that they've actually compensated at the other end in the evening by going to bed earlier. So it is a problem. Sleep in the elderly certainly is a problem. And some things are natural changes in the elderly, as say that loss of slow wave sleep. But certainly we shouldn't put up with things like sleep apnea or getting up and going to the bathroom more than once or twice a night. These things are not natural changes. And we shouldn't, as we get older, just say, what can I expect? I'm old, I'm falling to bits. So there are bits that change naturally with sleep, but there are other things that can be treated or rectified. And we should make sure that we do so to ensure the best sleep that we can get as we get older.
I just wanted to add to that. I read some research recently related to this idea as we get older, our eyesight starts to fail. And because light is the primary cue for synchronizing our body clocks, we're not actually processing light as efficiently as when we're younger. So the cues for our body clock is not as strong as we get older. I thought that was an interesting finding.
Yeah, it is. I mean, as you say, we respond, we've known for a couple of decades now that we respond to light in the blue part of the spectrum, which tells us it's day. And as you say, something like cataracts or something like that. And if you think about it, we have the signal in, which is sunlight. We have the brain. And if anybody tells you they know how the brains work, they're a fool. So you imagine the brain as a black box. And then you have the output, which is our circadian rhythm and our behavior. And so if there is a problem with the input, that the input is diminished in any way by, as you say, failing eyesight or cataracts or something like that, then, of course, the output will be affected in a way. And this might be part of why the elderly, part of why the elderly have that shift to going to bed earlier, they may be, you know, not getting the signal from light dark cycle that we would do so when we're 20. So no, it's a very interesting part of you know, the way that everything's connected, that, you know, that your eyesight can potentially affect your sleep pattern to a large degree.
Continually fascinated. Every day, you know, some news item about a research study will pop up. As you say, it's a massive big puzzle, isn't it? We're still trying to work on this stuff.
It is, yes.
Brilliant. Okay, moving on. Next myth. So everyone generally works hard in the week and they say, oh, it's okay, I will catch up on my sleep at the weekends.
You know, I spend my life lecturing to people and I'm forever fascinated why people apply some sort of perverse logic to sleep that they don't actually use for any other aspect that they do. I mean, you know, my analogy for this idea that you can catch up with your sleep at the weekend is like, you know, you spend all week eating junk food and then you catch up on a healthy diet by just eating lettuce at the weekend. I mean, that would be a crazy presumption to make and nobody would make it. And yet somehow, this always seems to me like they want an excuse rather than actually that they're catching up on the weekend. You will catch up on sleep at the weekend, i.e. you will have more sleep at the weekend if you have deprived yourself of sleep during the week, because sleep deprivation is a stress to the body and the body wishes to rectify this. Now, this is not a good thing to put your body under stress for 5 nights and then sleep longer at the weekends. Now, there's two aspects of this. One is the body craves rhythm. The body would love to go to bed and get up pretty regular times. And certainly one of the biggest and most effective changes people can make to their sleep is to actually fix wake-up time, because we know from the work of Jan Braun that the body and the brain starts waking up 90 minutes before we actually get out of bed. So if the body knows when you're going to get up, it can prepare and get ready to hit the ground running, which is why you can wake up ordinarily before your alarm clock. So the body craves regularity. And the other thing that the body wants is to get that right amount of sleep every night, each and every night, because that's what it needs to recover from the stresses and strains from the day. And so catching up at the weekend destroys that idea of having a regular wake-up time, which is why we get the Monday morning feeling. The Monday morning blues are down to the break of the regularity, your body thinking it's now on holiday and it doesn't have to get up an alarm clock. And then 7 o'clock Monday morning, the alarm clock goes on and the brain doesn't get the idea that it's now back into the work mode. And the other thing is this idea of catching up. You can only catch up a certain amount of your sleep. So if you went without a one night sleep, the next night you would make up all your missing slow wave sleep and half of your missing rapid eye movement sleep. So there is, you can't have 100% slow wave sleep, nor can you have 100% REM sleep. But you need to preserve these amounts. So yes, you can make up one or two bad nights sleep, but you can't make up an entire week's at the weekend. You can partially make up some of it, but you can't make all that you have missed. And therefore, you are always going to be running a sleep debt. And that is a big, big problem. So you need to get the right amount of sleep for you each and every night. Fix wake up time 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I certainly do that myself. I get up at 6:30 every morning, regardless of what time I go to bed. And that's the key. And I can't remember the last time I had a lie-in at the weekend. It's far better to get up, use your time productively, and keep that regularity.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because we're so locked into this Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 routine. And, you know, people naturally want to relax at the weekends. But as you say, you know, kids are probably the best example of this. You know, young children don't have a line at the weekends because they're not entrained to this sort of rhythm of society. It's difficult to drum that home to a lot of people, to say, well, you should be getting up at the same time on Saturday and Sunday as well, especially when you're young and you know you like to go out partying. But those are the facts, as you say. We can't escape biology, and our bodies crave that rhythm you talk about.
Absolutely. And the thing is, of course, you know, the one thing we have is we have free will. We can do whatever we like with our sleep. However, we will pay the price for it. I mean, nature has this wonderful way of punishing us when we go against her. So, you know, yes, when you're young, your sleep is very, very robust. I mean, you have all of that deep sleep that I mentioned in my previous answer. You will sleep well. You will sleep effectively. But as you get past your 20s, as you start losing that deep sleep, your sleep is far more fragile. And so we need to give it every help that we can, and you know, not sleeping at weekends or not sleeping in at weekends. I mean, you can lounge around in bed reading the Sunday Times if you want, but that's okay. But sleeping late is not a good idea.
Well, I'm going to skip on. I had another question lined up, but this leads on this next point. So this is about chronotypes, and chronotype is a scientific terminology for whether you have a predisposition to wake up in the morning or night, or what they call larks or owls. And because of these rhythms of work and society, we're kind of often taught that we all have to be morning people. And I think there's a myth that, you know, if you are, by your biology and by your DNA, a late chronotype, an owl, someone who has a predisposition to waking up late, there's a lot of stigma sometimes saying, well, you need to be a morning person. So I want to talk about this myth that you can learn to be a morning person.
Yeah, I mean, this is again one of these things where you have this idea of larks and owls, and you think that, you know, because one is more attractive than the other, that somehow you can train yourself to be it. Now, the problem is, as you say, if it's to quite a large degree genetically determined, and we know the genes that are in, or some of the genes that are involved. And so with morningness and eveningness, about 25% of people are strong morning people, about 25% of people are strong evening people, and the rest are sort of in the middle with no strong preference. And, you know, there are these studies that show that if you're a morning person, you have a lower risk of certain cancers and that sort of thing. And therefore, it would seem sensible to want to be a morning person. But, you know, I'm 6'5" tall, and that's got a lot to do with my genes. Now, I can read studies saying that if you're tall, you're going to die of this, that, or the other. Well, what can I do about it? I can't. I'm 6'5" tall. And the same with morningness and eveningness. If that's your chronotype, again, as I said in the last answer, you can do what you like. You know, whatever chronotype you are, you can set your alarm for 5 o'clock in the morning, all well and good. You'll wake up and you can be functioning, but you will not be functioning at your best. And, you know, till Rosenberg came up with this idea of social jet lag, where we suffer jet lag in our everyday life because we're not functioning according to our chronotype. So you will be functioning, but you won't be functioning at your best. And, you know, so this is something, you know, people rarely want to accept what they are. But again, you know, there's this idea that evening people are much more fun and have more friends, which may be true. And of course, being awake in the evening is a lot easier than being awake in the morning, because there's better telly on and pubs don't open that early, nor would you drink before you went to work. So we've created this society, and, you know, regardless of how much technology has allowed us to, you know, get past the demarcation of time, we still live roughly a sort of a 9-to-5 day. Which does put people who are evening people at a disadvantage, because they have to wake up at a time that they really don't want to be functioning and alert, and they suffer what we call sleep inertia, which is that feeling of grogginess that they have for anywhere between 15 minutes and 2 hours in the morning because they're getting up at the wrong time. But as I say, it's to a very large degree genetic, and we can't, you know, we can't override our genes, so we can't train ourselves.
Just very briefly, what can people do if they are, you know, have a preference for eveningness, or they say they're an owl?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, I mean, again, I alluded to in an earlier answer is the rhythm. If you're going to try and, you know, be a morning person and you are actually an evening person, is to have that rhythm of waking up every day at the same time, even at the weekends, because the minute that you go off that rhythm at the weekend, you'll revert back to type and you'll have to start again. So fixing your wake up time is the most important. Light is the most important time giver, Zeitgeber, that we have. And so exposure to early morning light, sunlight is best, but you know, leaping out of bed and switching all the lights on in the house. And if you are really serious about it, then using bright light, artificial bright light, 10,000 lux blue light in the early morning can help get your body kickstarted. Certainly now as we're moving into winter, the idea of seeing the sun is a bit of a non-starter. So, you know, if you're really serious about having to get up in the morning, then investing in a light box may potentially help you.
Brilliant tips, routine and lots of light in the morning. Okay, so next point. This is quite a common one, and I think maybe a lot of people know the reasons behind this, but I think there is a bit of a myth, and we're talking about teenagers. I struggle to remember back that far. I don't know about you, Neil. The myth of the lazy teenager who can't get out of bed. Now, certainly this was something until before I started getting into sleep and becoming a sleep junkie and someone passionate about sleep, which is less than 10 years ago. This is something that was a new idea to me. But there is this myth that teenagers, you know, they just want to stay in bed all the time.
Yeah, I mean, teenagers are different and teenagers are odd. Teenagers are different because they actually genuinely need more sleep than adults. The reason for this is they're going through puberty, and so there are physical, emotional changes that are happening to the teenager, and this means that they need to have more sleep in order to process these changes. So your average teenager needs about 9 to 9.5 hours sleep a night. Now, teenagers are odd because for some reason, teenagers do need to go to bed later than adults. There's actually a shift in their biological rhythm. And I say we don't have a clue why, but it's definitely there. However, that shift is only at most 2 hours. So your average teenager should be going to bed around 11, 11:30 and sleeping between 9 and 9.5 hours, which means that a teenager who cannot get out of bed at 9 o'clock in the morning might actually be telling you the truth, whereas a teenager who cannot get out of bed until 3 o'clock in the afternoon is really just genuinely lazy. So there is this definite shift there. And this is the problem for teenagers, going back to what we were talking about, morningness and eveningness. Somebody once said that, you know, for a teenager to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning is like an adult getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We're out of our chronotype in that regard. And this is why there's this big argument about putting school start times later, so we're not forcing teenagers to get up so early, because they really can't function. So there is some truth in that it's a myth, but yes, teenage laziness is their attitude, not their desire for sleep.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because it's a fact. Teenagers, they have a shift, what's called a phase delay in their body clock. So they do biologically, it's the time of their life where they need to go to bed later. But also teenagers are stroppy and argumentative and emotional. And
absolutely.
And I guess looking at this in the bigger picture, it's all tied together because you say it's a mystery. We don't fully know why teenagers need to go to bed later. But we do know there are massive hormonal changes going on, and we're probably going to make some findings in the future that this is all tied in with the reasons that they're sleeping later. But obviously that has impact on their emotions, and teenagers just being, you know, emotionally teenagers as well.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And this is the thing, you know, if you think about it, you know, in the wider context, teenagers didn't actually exist until the 1950s, 1960s, because you left school and you were an adult and you were treated like an adult. You know, I started work when I was 16, you know, working with the Royal Air Force. There was no way that I was ever going to be a teenager or be stroppy, because I had to be at work for 8:30 and work a full day. So this idea of the teenager is a modern phenomenon. But, you know, there are, as you say, these big hormonal changes that take place in the teenager. But whether teenagers are actually, you know, a subspecies where they are different, or whether it's something that we've caused in them, you know, because now 50% of teenagers go to university. This wasn't something that happened in my day. You know, 10% went. So they don't have that structure or rhythm, and maybe they've just drifted.
Brilliant. Okay, well, moving on. Okay, well, I had a really interesting chat with a Brian Crone a couple of weeks back, who's invented this app. I don't know if you saw it. We were talking about snoring, but I just wanted to get your take on this as well. So snoring, people kind of laugh about it and say, oh, you know, I heard you snoring last night, you know, your wife or your partner. So the myth I want to talk about is that snoring is harmless. Whereas actually, you know, my personal view is we don't really take snoring seriously enough.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with snoring is that it's you know, sort of been the butt of music hall jokes for so many years. It is somehow, you know, difficult to actually take it seriously. And the problem is that snoring is a problem. It's a problem both to the snorer and also to the bed partner. Because the World Health Organization says that in order to get a good night's sleep, your bedroom should be around 35 decibels with intermittent peaks of around 45 decibels. Now, 45 decibels is if you're sleeping close to a road and you have your window open at night and a truck goes past. So that's about 45 decibels. Now, for a snorer, this can be anywhere between 70 and 95 decibels, so really, really loud. So it's hardly surprising that that's going to disturb your bed partner and cause them to have a very poor night's sleep. But because it is actually so loud, the snorer can wake themselves up. They might not be perceiving this. It will cause arousals rather than full awakenings, but this will actually destroy the continuity of sleep. And so snoring can, just in itself, be a problem for sleep. But snoring can also be a precursor in some people for much more serious breathing disorders during the night, specifically obstructive sleep apnea. Obstructive sleep apnea is very easy to diagnose. Essentially, if your bed partner stops breathing during the night for over 10 seconds on a number of occasions, they have sleep apnea. It's as simple as that. What you need to find out is the severity of sleep apnea.
Just to interrupt briefly, Neil, just for anyone out there who doesn't know what sleep apnea is, it's a big problem, isn't it? It's millions of people. Can you just give us a very brief explanation?
Okay. Sleep apnea is where, because of the upper airway at the back of the throat, that the soft tissue at the back of the airway can close the airway. And so what happens with sleep apnea is that you have usually 5 or 6 loud snores, and then you have a pause in your breathing because the airway has closed. And then the body overcomes that obstruction. And so you get a roaring snore as you overcome, because you're trying to breathe against that obstruction. And every time you do that, with that roaring snore, you actually wake yourself up. And that causes you to lose the continuity of sleep. Then you'll have another 5 or 6 snores, and then you'll pause again. And sleep apnea, because it's putting such a strain on the body, because the body's trying to breathe against that obstruction, sleep apnea is known to increase blood pressure significantly, and because of that is very much associated with an increased risk of things like stroke. And because it's destroying the continuity of your sleep, people who suffer sleep apnea have severe daytime sleepiness. they may notice the sleepiness, they may notice their memory is suffering quite badly. And the problem is, in elderly people, if they're unaware that they're having sleep apnea, they may just think it's part of them getting old. So the report of the bed partner who notices these pauses is absolutely key for these people. And as I say, sleep apnea is easily treatable in the majority of people, either using a device that blows air through the airway, so it keeps the airway open, the continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP. CPAP works really well. The key with CPAP is you actually have to wear it. So it works. If you keep it in the box beside your bed, don't expect it to do anything. So you have to wear it. And the other possible solution is using a mandibular advancement device, which is something akin to a boxer's gum shield, can be fitted personally by a dentist, which just keeps the jaw slightly forward, so that stops the airway from closing during the night. So both of these are highly effective when used correctly. And if you do suspect your partner does have sleep apnea, then take them to the GP as soon as you can and get it sorted out. But I say that because, you know, some people can snore for Britain and not have sleep apnea, but that snoring is still going to be disturbing their sleep and increasing their blood pressure, not as much as apnea, but significantly. So snoring needs to be sorted out. As I say, there are lotions and potions in your local chemists. Some of these work for some people. They're not that expensive, so it's worth experimenting with them. As you mentioned, this app, which gets you to use vocal exercises to strengthen the upper airway, it's founded on good science, and you know, it could be a solution for some people. There is a surgical operation that some people advocate for snoring, the so-called UPPP. Now, the problem with that is it does work in about 25% of people. It doesn't work in about 50% of people and actually makes snoring worse in 25% of the people. And there's no guarantee who it will work in. Essentially, with that operation, they either use a knife or a laser or an RF probe, a radio frequency probe, just to cut some of this soft tissue from the back of the back of the throat. It's a pretty
last option, I would say.
Well, it's last option. It's sort of a skin of the pants surgery. You know, there's no guidelines as to how much you should take away or where you should take it away from. And as I say, it doesn't work in a lot of people, and that could be a big problem for you know, some people. If you've paid a couple of £1,000 for this operation, it's actually made the snoring worse. That isn't going to be the proper outcome for you.
It's interesting, you know, what you talked about at the start there. Snoring may be the butt of jokes, but the very fact that you are snoring and that the sound level is increased in the room is going to have a disruptive effect on your sleep, regardless of whether you have a condition like sleep apnea. The very fact that there's noise disturbance, you know, you won't perceive that in the morning that you are being woken up, but your sleep will be disrupted. One other thing I wanted to say as well, I saw a video. I mean, sleep apnea is quite horrific. I mean, you literally, patients are stopping breathing for 30 seconds, you know, multiple times a night. And I saw a video of a sleep clinic, and they basically filmed the patients and then when they watched the videos back, they were horrified by seeing themselves stopping breathing in the night. And they all went back on their CPAP. So I would say that's something, a tip that anyone can do, is a very easy thing to do. Just stick a camera up. If you've got one of these modern ones, they tend to be quite good in the low light.
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem with CPAP. It works as long as you wear it. And the problem is the press. You know, I'm sick of seeing these stories about, oh, it makes me look like Darth Vader. Or whatever, you know, it's just this thing will
help. They're getting smaller and smaller as well, aren't they?
and quieter and that. Yeah, I mean, it is a problem with the old. I mean, I know the guy who built the first ever CPAP machine in the UK, and it was a reverse engineered Hoover. And yeah, of course, that's going to keep you awake and make you look stupid. But, you know, nowadays, you know, you're talking about your health here. If you don't wear it during intimacy, and there has been some work that actually shows that wearing your CPAP, and using it effectively actually improves your sex life, because you're, you know, including, you know, from a physical point of view. So, you know, it's a win-win situation. You'll feel younger, your memory will come back, and you'll have more and more satisfying sex with your bed partner. Doesn't really matter what you look like in the dark.
There you go. Okay, brilliant. Well, let's go on. This is the last point I want to talk about today. And maybe it's slightly related to this subject of snoring as well. And there's a connection there. But the idea of drinking alcohol, it makes you sleepy at night. And, you know, I'll just have a little drink before I go to sleep because I can't relax. So I want to talk about this myth that having a nightcap at night will help you sleep better.
Yeah, I mean, alcohol is the most widely used sleep aid in the world, and it's the oldest sleep aid in the world. We've always drunk before bed, and strictly speaking, from a scientific point of view, alcohol is actually quite good at putting you to sleep. It works on the same receptor that sleeping tablets do. But the problems with alcohol are threefold. One is that it makes you pee during the night, so you have to get up, so your night's disturbed. The other, because it's dehydrating, you get that horrible headache at some point during the night, which is liable to disturb you. And the third one, which people perhaps don't really realize as much, is that alcohol, being very, very calorific, actually causes you to be hot during the night. And we've all experienced waking up after a session with our pillow soaking wet and sweating. Now, the issue with that is that you are meant to lose body temperature over the night. I mean, as we mentioned right at the start, your metabolism dials down because you don't want to do work at night. You need to lose this body temperature as you go through the night. And if you're burning off calories from alcohol or, you know, big calorific fatty meals during the night, your body is working when it shouldn't be working, and it's producing heat when it needs to be cooling down. So alcohol affects you in these ways.
So what does that do to the actual structure of your sleep then, the fact that you're burning more calories?
Well, sleep becomes more disturbed. You toss and turn more. You feel uncomfortable during the night. There is a genuine feeling of uncomfort or discomfort during the night, and all of this disturbs sleep. So you get a rebound. You have deep sleep for a few hours. I mean, we all know that feeling of literally passing out when we get into bed and not moving. And then you wake up and you feel terrible. And of course, if you feel terrible, you're going to find it difficult to go back to sleep. So you feel uncomfortable, you feel restless, and your sleep is more liable to be disturbed. But, you know, a nightcap has never hurt anybody. You know, a small sherry or a tot of whiskey before going to bed has never hurt anybody, as long as you're doing it as part of a nice wind down routine. But, you know, drinking to excess, you know, more than a small nightcap will actually disturb your sleep. So don't, you know, that you know, nice brandy after, you know, if you've eaten a three-course meal and had half a bottle of wine, a small brandy or a port or a sweet sherry at the end of the night isn't going to be the reason you don't sleep that night. So, you know, we can, of course, give up alcohol and not have a nightcap. But, I mean, it's like that old joke, isn't it? You know, the guy goes to the doctor and says, "I want to live longer." And the doctor says, "Give up smoking, drinking and women." And the guy says, "Well, will I really sleep longer?" He said, "No, but you'll just feel like it." This is the only life we have. And I'd hate to deny you know, an 80-year-old woman her sweet sherry just before bed because she likes it. But, you know, it's being sensible. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, it's like everything, everything in moderation.
But it will essentially, it will disrupt what happens. You skip your N1 sleep, you go straight into deep sleep.
You go straight into deep sleep, and then, as I say, you get rebound. So you come out from an extended period of deep sleep, and then you're into a much lighter, more easily disturbed N2, N1, and REM sleep. I've seen some people advise, you know, alcohol is the biggest disruptor of sleep. Well, yeah, or, you know, avoid alcohol always. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, you have to, quality of life has to go with quality of night. There has to be a trade-off somewhere. But if you're drinking half a bottle of Tesco's Value Scotch at night, there's probably a problem far beyond your sleep problem.
What about this thing when you wake up early? You'd think if you got plastered the night before, you just sleep over, but it's quite common that you'll wake up early.
You'll wake up mainly because of the dehydration, which your brain has shrunk and is pulling against the meninges, and that's why you get that blooming awful headache in the morning. And then there's the discomfort. You know, you'll have gastro problems because of the alcohol. You will have the sweating and that sort of thing. So that's the thing. You'll get a good night's sleep for a number of hours, but then the latter part of the night will pretty much be destroyed after you've had a lot of alcohol. So you will wake up. And once you wake up and you feel discomfort, then there's very, very little way that you're going to ever fall back to sleep.
All right. Brilliant. So the takeaway is, you know, we don't have to give up. We don't have to become teetotal, but if you have too much, then it's not gonna act like the best sleeping pill in the world. It's actually gonna do the opposite.
Absolutely.
Brilliant, Neil. Fantastic. I think we should revisit this topic at some other stage, and because there's plenty more myths out there, and if you're up for it, you know, we could do a bit of myth busting together again.
It would be a pleasure.
Neil, anything about anything you want to talk about that what you're doing, or anything you want to publicize, or maybe just talk about your website?
I have a book that came out earlier this year called How to Sleep Well, which basically is a myth busting book, and my website is thesleepconsultancy.com.
Yeah, Neil's book is really good, actually. I've always got about two or three sleep books on the go at once, but I'm dipping in and out of your book, Neil, and it's great. So yeah, recommended. Fantastic. All right, I will let you get on. Thanks again, Neil. We shall talk again soon.
Yeah, it'd be a great pleasure, Jeff. Take care.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann from sleepjunkies.com. If you like what you heard today, then it would be great if you could help us spread the word about sleep and about sleep health by leaving a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate your support and help on that. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. We've also got a Facebook group. You can join the community there. It's called Sleep Junkies Worldwide. So stay tuned. We hope you subscribe, and we'll see you on the next one.